Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to Creating a Family. Talk about infertility and adoption. On today's show, we're going to be talking about premature ovarian failure, its causes, and its treatment. I think you're going to learn a lot from this show. Here's a sample of what you'll hear.
If someone starts out with a lower number of eggs at puberty, then they're more likely to go through menopause at an earlier time frame. Or if there's some accelerating factor where they lose them more rapidly, they're more likely to go through menopause at an earlier time frame. Or if they're exposed to something that caused premature depletion of that allotment, they'll go through menopause at an earlier time frame.
I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility and Adoption Education and Support Nonprofit. You can find us online at creatingafamily.org. You can also join our very large, very active online support group. We're having some great discussions over there right now, and we'd love to have you join us. And you can find that. It's a Facebook group, a closed group, and you can find that at facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily, or just type the words creating a family in the Facebook search box, and the group will pop up. So will the page. You can like the page and join the group. It is a closed group, so you do have to request, and we will have to approve you to let you in. As you probably have heard, everyone, we have already ended our two-week celebration for reaching the 1 millionth listener for this radio show. We had a raffle. The winners of the $500, $250, and $100 Amazon gift cards are located on the site. I thank you so much for all the wonderful testimonials and comments that we received about how Creating a Family has helped you and on your journey and on your struggles, and it really was very meaningful. They are just some funny ones, a lot of heartfelt ones. So please, you can go to that page on our website and read them, and you can also see who won the raffle. The Creating a Family radio show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. For many patients, cost can be a barrier to pursuing fertility treatment. That's why Ferring offers a savings card for their Endometrin vaginal inserts. This instant savings card offers up to $100 savings each month on your Endometrin prescription for eligible patients. To get more information, you can ask your doctor for more details. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support of our gold sponsors who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create their family. Some of our wonderful gold sponsors include Reproductive Medicine Associates of New Jersey. They are a recognized scientific and patient care leader in the field of infertility. They have 10 offices and 21 physicians throughout New Jersey, and they maintain an IVF delivery rate well above the national average. We also have Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of a prospective sperm donor to provide the client with a personalized catalog of safer donor matches. And we have some other gold sponsors that I will mention later in the show. In addition to our gold sponsors, we also have other great sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. We ask that when choosing an infertility service provider, please consider choosing one from the Creating a Family directories, which you can find on the service provider page of our site. You can search by location, services provided, number of years in operation, just a whole host of factors that we think are important when choosing. And by using these directories, you support those who support us, and we thank you. Today, we're going to be talking about a very popular topic with our audience, premature ovarian failure, its causes, and its treatment. Our guest today is Dr. Timothy Hickman. He is the medical director and co-founder of Houston IVF. He holds clinical associate's professor appointments at both the University of Texas Medical School in Houston, as well as the Baylor College of Medicine. He is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist, and he has served on the executive board of the Society of Assisted Reproductive Technology from 2001 to 2011. Additionally, he has been named as a top doctor in reproductive endocrinology by U.S. News and World Report, a top doctor and top doctor for women by H. Texas Magazine and Texas Superdocs by, I like that one, Texas Superdoc by Texas Monthly Magazine. Welcome, Dr. Timothy Hickman, to Creating a Family.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Our original guest, I should tell everyone, since we advertise this, was to be Dr. Bill Schoolcraft with the Colorado Center for Reproductive Medicine. He had a family emergency come up, and we are so thankful that that Dr. Timothy Hickman is pinch hitting for him. And as we just heard from your from your intro, it is maybe it was the reverse, that he was pinch hitting for you. That's quite a powerful. I love that one, Super Doc. From having been at living in Texas for a number of years, I was a big fan of Texas Monthly Magazine, so that's quite an honor to have received.
Oh, well, thank you.
All right. As I mentioned at the onset, this is a very popular topic for our audience. So we've got a lot of questions which we'll be asking. But I think before we get into our questions, let's start at the beginning, always a good place to begin. What is premature ovarian failure, and how is it defined? I mean, you know, let's be honest, is it a decrease in egg production and ovarian function is a normal part of aging? So what makes it premature? At what point do we consider it premature as opposed to just a normal part of aging?
That's a great question. The typical time a woman goes through menopause here in the United States is somewhere between 50 and 51. Now, you'll see variations on that a little bit further into the late 50s or mid-50s to late 50s or even the 40s. But if a woman goes through menopause before the age of 40, we consider that premature ovarian failure.
So any time after 40, it's not considered premature ovarian failure. But before then, if it's pre-40, okay, so how do we know whether a woman is defined as entering menopause?
So the classic definition is if a woman goes through 12 months without a period, and in addition to that has two blood tests that show a markedly elevated FSH in the menopausal range, that's how one comes up with that definition of menopause.
Okay, so FSH test is the, well, both that and the cessation of menses, the cessation of having a menstrual period, and then an elevated FSH, so an FSH test, that's the diagnostic criteria, that's what we use to diagnose premature ovarian failure?
That's correct. You have to come in those two situations, early age, less than 40, and then the biochemical verification also with the elevated FSH.
So if a woman is less than 40 and she's missing periods, should she wait a full year before trying to get a diagnosis? Because I would imagine it's not just an immediate cessation. It's more of a beginning to skip periods and have irregularity and then ultimately resulting in a 12-month skip. But do you recommend people wait until they – when should they go try to seek a diagnosis?
Oh, no, you wouldn't wait. If someone's interested in fertility treatment or getting pregnant, you wouldn't wait at all. You'd go seek evaluation. But if you're going to make that diagnosis formally, you'd have to have a full 12 months of no periods and then
gotcha.
The biochemical confirmation to go along with that. So, no, okay. Don't wait.
Yeah, don't wait. Yeah. As we say all the time, time is not on your side when it comes to fertility at all. And just let me throw this out now. Everybody has heard this and who has listened to this show for any length of time. But if you are under the age of 35 and have tried with timed intercourse for a year without getting pregnant, you need to see a specialist. And the specialist for infertility is a reproductive endocrinologist. And if you are over 35, I sure wouldn't try more than about 6 months before seeking a specialist. That's still, Dr. Hickman, that's still the what we're recommending?
Absolutely. Then I think I would add to that, at 40, even with regular cycles, you almost come right away.
Yeah.
So that's where we qualified that. Less than 35, if you're having regular cycles and you don't really perceive anything to be wrong, we think the sperm count's fine and eggs are being released, and as far as we know, the anatomy's fine. We can wait a year. If it's 35, you try that for 6 months, and then at 40, pretty much you go straight away and say, all right, let's get going.
Yeah, what do we need to do at this point to up my odds? I've heard this condition called different things, and in fact, at one point, there seemed to be a push to change the name. Premature menopause is what a lot of people know it by. Premature ovarian failure. What else is it called?
There is something called ovarian insufficiency. People refer to it that way, but probably the most common is POF, or premature ovarian failure, is the one that's used mostly.
Mm-hmm. That's the one we're hearing now, and there seems to be a kind of a movement away from calling it premature menopause. So we're trying to just call POF, premature ovarian failure. Other than the inability to get pregnant, what are the symptoms of POF?
Well, the symptoms are much like those of menopause that occur at the regular time frame. In other words, hot flashes, vaginal dryness, issues sometimes with irritability, sleep pattern changes, things like that. So in a hypoestrogenic state, in a state where there is very low estrogen, these things are the natural consequences. The risks associated with these tend to be those associated with menopause also. In other words, lack of estrogen puts one at risk for thinning of the bones or osteoporosis. It also puts one at risk for heart disease in an earlier time frame. And, of course, the earlier this occurs in life, the greater the risk for that individual.
Because they have more time that their body is exposed to the lack of estrogen. Is that
exactly.
The reason why? Yeah,
that's exactly sense. Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Now, we got the most questions, in fact, all of our questions this time, came on the causes for premature ovarian failure. And we do have a lot of them. They are repetitive, so I'm not going to read all of them. I'm going to start with two, because they're the two of the most general. Athena asks, why do we have premature ovarian failure? Is it exposure to chemicals like lead paint, chemicals in my new car, sunscreen, or any of these that would cause that, or pollution in general? Are there genetic issues? Is the stress on the moms during pregnancy a factor? I've heard that it is. Even if he, meaning you, can't say why, can he review the major theories as to why I have this and my sister doesn't? Even if he doesn't believe any of them, can he review the theories of origin out there? I find it healing to be able to ponder the many theories and know that it's not just something terrible that I did to myself. And we have another question from Stephanie, and she says, I want to know what causes this, whether genetics cause this. I have POF diagnosed at 25 when me and my husband were seeking infertility treatment. My sister doesn't have POF and has two children. My mother had my little sister at age 41. My ESR rates have been within the normal range. All right, so let's start with the general, what do we know about what causes this? And then we'll go into the specific things that both that Athena mentioned. So why do some women have premature ovarian failure when the majority of us do not?
Those are all great questions. I think it's probably best to start off with just kind of a little male and female physiology and embryology. So men and women.
Yeah. Let's start. Yeah.
Yeah. Start way back there.
Yeah. Let's start at the very beginning. I like that.
Men and women are very different.
No
surprise to a lot
again.
Of people. But reproductively, they're very different. So men continually produce sperm throughout life. So they are born without any sperm. At 15, as they go through puberty, they start developing sperm. Then they continue to develop those sperm throughout life. So those sperm that are created are always new. They're always about 72 days old. And that's why occasionally we'll see these 8-year-old men having babies with 20-year-old women. or something like that. But you don't see the opposite. We don't see 80-year-old women having babies with 20-year-old men, because women have a certain allotment of eggs, and those are actually formed at about, they reach their peak at about 20 weeks gestation. So even before birth, they're somewhere between 5 to 6 million. At the time birth occurs, that number goes down to about 1 to 2 million. At the time puberty occurs, typically we're down to about 300,000. And that's kind of the allotment of eggs one has for their reproductive years, which are typically about 35 years from 15 to 50. Now, if someone, just in general with premature ovarian failure, if someone starts out with a lower number of eggs at puberty, then they're more likely to go through menopause at an earlier time frame. Or if there's some accelerating factor where they lose them more rapidly, they're more likely to go through menopause at an earlier time frame. Or if they're exposed to something that caused premature depletion of that allotment, they'll go through menopause at an earlier time frame. So let's talk about each of those. For one, and this is not gratifying to say this, but unfortunately for most cases, we never find out a reason. It just happens. And we look at all the environmental factors, we look at the genetic factors, we look at the autoimmune factors, and we don't find out why it happened. It just happened. But for those things that we know, genetic factors, we'll talk about that first. So some women are born with some type of mutation or with a mosaicism. The most common is probably a Turner syndrome mosaicism, where they have premature loss of that allotment because of that genetic factor. Those can run in families, but are fairly rare. The way you would diagnose something like that would be to get your blood drawn and ask for a karyotype. We also see that just in general, we'll see this sometimes run in families. In other words, let's say a woman's mother went through menopause in her early 40s. Her mother, so the initial woman's grandmother, went through menopause in her early 40s or late 30s. And also the woman's siblings or sisters went through menopause in an earlier time frame. We don't know exactly why that happens. There's not a genetic test that will actually verify that for the most part, but we just do see that running through different family lines.
And we don't know, and there's not, we haven't uncovered if there is a genetic, I mean, there's actually something on the DNA that will, because this is not Turner syndrome, this is something totally separate.
That would be totally separate, typically.
Okay.
And the answer is yes, there's probably something there, we just don't know what it is yet. Now, in this age of medicine, as we're doing more and more genome sequencing and figuring out what actually all those C's and D's and T's and A's mean, we're going to probably figure some of this stuff out in the next 5 to 10 years. But right now, it's still a bit of a mystery for a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to know in the future because it is a fascinating. All right, so that's if there's a genetic cause. All right, and you, let me go back to say, okay, you said that there were different ways premature ovarian failure can express themselves. That's not exactly, I'm not doing a good job of paraphrasing, but one was you could have, when you reach puberty, you could have a lower number of eggs at puberty, which hence would mean you have fewer eggs to start with, so to speak. And the other one that you mentioned was an accelerated rate of reduction, which would indicate that you're going to run out sooner or get too low at it sooner. Was there another scenario that you mentioned?
Yes, there would be some factor that would be introduced that would cause premature depletion. For example, chemotherapy, radiation, things like that, that would actually kill off egg cells.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. And in that case, the cause is obvious. All right, so we've talked about the genetics that would cause a woman potentially to have either a lower number of eggs at puberty or or perhaps not just even at puberty, but from 20 weeks gestation, for whatever reason, that person has produced fewer eggs. And so what are the other things that might cause a woman to have fewer eggs in general?
I would say, so going to the next thing of this premature depletion, there's this whole host of different ways the immune system goes awry. We call those, we lump them into the big category of autoimmune causes. What that means is that the body is making antibodies against typically certain glands. Like we know, you probably have several friends, as I do, that have problems with their thyroid. So that's a very common gland that fails in about maybe as high as 20% of reproductive age women, where they'll need to take replacements if it's functioning at a low level. And that is a gland that is typically the reason for the decline of the thyroid hormone production is typically an autoimmune situation, that the immune system has kind of gone to fight off, think that the thyroid gland is a foreign entity, so it's kind of fighting it off, and therefore you have lower function there. That's just one example of a gland that can have decreased function or fail due to an autoimmune issue. Another would be the ovary. So if there's some autoimmune issue, that could cause a problem with the ovary also.
Is there a name for, I mean, I know of certain autoimmune diseases. Isn't diabetes considered one? And certainly lupus is considered one. Maybe diabetes is not, but lupus is.
Certainly is, yeah. So there are a whole host of different autoimmune diseases, and not everyone with an autoimmune disease will have an issue with premature ovarian failure. But a very small percentage will, and we don't know exactly the mechanism. We just know there are associations here.
And so is that all autoimmune? So if any autoimmune condition could result in premature ovarian failure, am I understanding you correctly?
I would say a very small percentage of the big group of autoimmune diseases have an association with premature ovarian failure.
Okay. But if you've been diagnosed in the past, we actually have a question from Robin. She says, are those with autoimmune diseases more susceptible to premature ovarian failure? And I'm assuming that the answer to that is yes.
That is correct, yes.
Okay. All right.
So it is a higher risk if you have a history of that.
Okay. What about environmental issues? Athena mentioned a number of them, and I assume that this would be a question for both at any stage in life, including including perhaps in gestation or childhood, exposure to chemicals like lead paint, sunscreen, pollution. So what about environmental exposures?
So the ones that are classically given that we know cause premature depletion are things like chemotherapy, especially alkylating agents, and radiation. As far as the others that you mentioned there, lead paint, sunscreens, etc., it's hard to say if we really have enough data to say there's a link there. So those are not the classic causes that we hear about. We certainly wonder about that, but we're not quite sure.
Do we see an increase, and I realize this would not be proof, but have we started seeing an increase in the incident of premature ovarian failure?
As far as we know, the answer is no to that. What's interesting, though, is what we're seeing is a much higher percentage of our population trying to reproduce about a decade later than we did two generations ago.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take a look at the history of the world and recorded time, we've tracked fertility charts and fertility percentages back as far as the 1500s. And we see that they're pretty similar to our modern day charts. In other words, we kind of peak at our fertility at age 20. And then we have a leveling off in the early 20s, gets a little lower, the upper 20s, stays about the same until the early 30s and starts to decline. If you look at that slope versus the slope that was generated in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, it's about the same. So we think that it's probably not the fact that things have changed so much in the environment, but rather that we've just delayed childbearing for other reasons, delaying because of increased education, increased workforce opportunities, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So it's like in the past we may have had premature women in their early 20s who are trying to conceive, if they are later going to have premature ovarian failure, but they're trying to conceive in their early 20s, they would have fewer eggs, but likely enough eggs, not everyone, but many of them would have enough eggs to actually have a conception, to be able to maintain a pregnancy or get pregnant. But if they had waited 10 years, they would have few enough eggs that at that point they would not have enough to get pregnant. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's exactly correct. Yeah, we've seen through many studies that if a couple tries to conceive at age 20, which doesn't happen very often now, but they tried, about 95% will be successful without any help from any outside source. But when that same couple, if they delayed until age 35, only about 65% would conceive without help. So one-third would not be able to have a child. If you wait till 40, then we're talking about two-thirds and only about 30% having a child without help. So pretty big drop-off in that time frame.
Right. You are listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. We are so glad to have you with us on this show talking about premature ovarian failure, its causes, and treatment. We primarily keep in touch with our audience through our weekly e-newsletter. We have two of them, and we have two, one for infertility and one for adoption, and you get to choose which one you want to get. We let you know about the latest developments as well as the upcoming week's blog and show topics. You can receive our newsletter by signing up on any page of our website, top right side, creatingafamily.org. All right. What about, we have a question from Noelle. She says, have there been any studies on the link between taking Accutane, a treatment for acne, as a teen to premature ovarian failure? I have always wondered.
That's a great question. I've not seen that study, but I've wondered about it, given the fact that several of my daughters went through the treatment. I've wondered if there's been any issue with that. So I have not seen any studies to that effect, but wonder.
Well, if there's environmental exposures, be they through medication or from anything, if we look at what you were saying, that the slope of decline from what we can tell has remained the same, is that giving us indication that, in fact, there isn't an environmental influence or that there's something we're being exposed to, since it's that slope that is not changing? Is that, if not proof, is that strong evidence that environmental factors are not influenced, or is that the MR, or am I being overly simplistic?
When one thinks about the state of the world right now, it seems like an easy conclusion to say there's got to be something that's different. You know, there's more pollution, there are more people in the world, there's more industrialization of the world going on. There's got to be something out there. Yet we have these other facts that kind of fly in the face of that, saying, well, the fertility slope looks about the same. My guess, and this is an educated guess, but it is a guess, is that there, I'm sure, is some factor where multiple factors in the environment that would be decreasing our ability to maintain our fertility. But we just don't know those exacts yet, and that with more study and more evaluation, we'll probably find them.
Let me add, and I will remember to link to this in the blog tomorrow. We have done a show on the effects of the environment on fertility. That's not exactly the name. The doctor who was on the show is out of Stanford. There's a center there for the environment and reproduction or something. I will link to it. It was a fascinating show, and she reviewed everything basically that is currently known about what environmental factors can impact and what we know and what's been shown with strong evidence and what is still speculation. I will link to that in the blog tomorrow as well. Beth asks, can losing one ovary pre-puberty lead to POF? Are there better ways to predict this earlier in life? That's a separate question, so let me just stick with her first one. How about losing one ovary pre-puberty? Would that make you more at risk for premature ovarian failure?
Well, since there's just a certain allotment of eggs that one has in life, and if you lose one ovary, you're losing about half of that allotment. Now, the body does re-regulate itself and therefore produce fewer eggs per cycle, but still one is at higher risk of going through premature ovarian failure after having lost an ovary. So the answer would be yes to that.
And here's a question that I have wondered myself and was really thankful that we got it. And this is from Melina. She said, can IVF, in vitro fertilization, lead to premature ovarian failure or early menopause? Is there any evidence that aggressive stimulation of the ovaries during a typical IVF cycle can contribute to POF? And I thought about that because especially when you hear, and this is atypical, but we do hear of women who have had many, many cycles of IVF, and their ovaries are, so they're producing many, many eggs, or some of them are, each cycle. So, yeah, what do we know as far as, again, the repeated use of IVF and ovarian stimulation as far as premature ovarian failure?
Well, that's an excellent question, and the short answer is there's probably not a link, but let's kind of go over the principles behind that answer. So every month, there is a group of eggs that develop. Now, they've probably been developing for 30 to 60 days before that particular cycle, but that cohort of eggs is the cohort that will potentially develop during that 1 month. And in a natural cycle, you know, the brain will send stimulation by the way of FSH and LH down to the ovary. And of that cohort, one of those eggs will become the dominant follicle. And it will go to full maturation, then release, ovulate. Then the rest of the eggs in that cohort that never became dominant will undergo a process called apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. And so they're killed off regardless. So in an IVF cycle, it's a different situation. You're taking pharmacologic doses of FSH and LH to try and stimulate that entire cohort to develop fully. And so many would refer to that as egg salvage. In other words, those eggs would have been lost anyway through that apoptotic process that would happen later on after release of the dominant follicle. But yet in this situation, you're just letting every one of them come to their full potential. So it is thought because of that there's not premature depletion. There's just use of everyone that was available in that particular cohort. So people have made the argument, which we've never done, that, oh, you could go ahead and stimulate every month of your reproductive life and still go through menopause at the same time. And that may or may not be true, but that's the logic behind that statement.
So, in other words, the gonadotropins, the ovulatory stimulating medications, basically make it such that there is not only one egg that becomes the dominant egg. It allows all of those who are ripening, or those eggs who are ripening that month, to all of them come to maturity.
Exactly. That's the goal of ovulation induction in an IVF cycle.
Interesting. Okay. We have a question from a different Robin, and she wants to know if you know anything about cases linking premature ovarian failure to the HPV vaccines, Gardasil or, I'm not sure how to pronounce the other one, Cervarix? Gardasil, so, I'm not familiar with Cervarix, but she's apparently a different form of the HPV vaccine. Have you heard anything? Has there been any research on that?
To my knowledge, there is no association, no known association with HPV vaccine exposure and premature ovarian failure, nor is there an increased risk with HPV that people just contract naturally through intercourse and develop cervical dysplasia and premature ovarian failure. So I wouldn't, there's not a scientific theory where those two would be linked, since they're two completely separate type of situations. So not that I know of.
You've already answered my next question. Is there a kind of a logical basis from, even though we don't know it, is there a logical way to think in terms of why either of those vaccines, either the vaccine or, as you point out, the virus itself, could affect ovarian reserves? And you're saying no, that's kind of, you can't think of a logical way that those would be connected.
That's correct.
Okay, interesting. All right, I'd like to take a moment to thank a few more of our gold sponsors and to remind you that it is through their very generous support that we can bring you this show, as well as all the resources at Creating a Family, and including our resources. We have a page on premature ovarian failure, and a page of resources on, I should add. And so all of these resources are provided by the generous support of our sponsors, including our gold sponsor, Fairfax Cryobank. They have been a leader in sperm donation for over 20 years and are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. We also have the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson. They are a South Carolina firm committed to adoption and assisted reproductive law, including providing gestational surrogacy matching program, as well as legal services for independent surrogacy, egg donation, and embryo donation matters. And lastly, we have Nightlight Christian Adoptions. They were a pioneer in offering embryo donation and adoption services to clients throughout the world through their Snowflakes Embryo Adoption Program. All right, now we've talked about causes, and let me ask, are there any other theories out there that we haven't mentioned? Getting back to, I think it was Athena who said, throw all the theories her way, that just because she likes to ponder. So are there any other theories that we've not covered, either well supported or not so well supported?
I think that pretty much covers them. So familial factors that we don't really know that much about, those that we do know about, typically Turner syndrome, autoimmune situations, and then exposure to something that would cause premature depletion like radiation or chemotherapy.
All right. And I should reiterate what you said earlier, and that is in most cases we never know the cause.
That's correct.
Right. I do want to go back and since I think it's fascinating to know that our peak number of eggs is at 20 weeks of gestation. Has there been any research on pregnancy factors? It would be a very long-term research because you'd have to wait so many years, but any type of exposures, I think it was Athena or someone mentioned, stress that would reduce the number of eggs that a fetus was producing at her peak at 20 weeks?
That's a fascinating question, and I know that that is an active area of research. This is what we term the epigenetic causes of fetal development. So in other words, what the mother carrying the baby is contributing to the whole situation, even though not affecting the genetics, but rather the environment in which the baby grows.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to that has got to be yes in some way, but we don't know exactly what ways yet.
Yeah, that is absolutely fascinating. And also scary in a way, because it's like one more thing to worry about, in pregnancy. But nonetheless, I'm hoping. Well, I have not heard of if anything's going to be presented at ASRM this year, but ASRM, which for our is the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, their annual conference, which is one of the highlights of my year as far as finding new research to share with everyone. That conference is in just a couple of weeks, and I will certainly be on the lookout there. I've not heard of anything that's going to be presented on this, but I've actually only seen those people who are speaking, not papers and posters and things like that. All right, moving now to treatment. We've talked about the causes. Now, as to the treatment, let's start with medical treatment, Western medical treatment, and then we'll move on to talking about any other forms of treatment. In the past, if a woman has very few eggs, what can we tell her to do? How effective is IVF? How effective is IUI at that point? And it might depend upon how deeply depleted her ovarian supplies are. But nonetheless, so what is the typical treatment both in the past and what's currently happening now in 2015?
So if someone has purely premature ovarian failure, in other words, they've met that diagnosis of not having a period for a year, and then they have markedly elevated FSH values, there are not a lot of treatments that are available. I mean, traditionally what has been done is people might try to use gonadotropins. The rationale there is that if you give more FSH, maybe you'll have a success, and maybe you'll have an ovulation take place. But that rarely is ever effective, because if you can think of it, if your FSH level is already markedly elevated to meet this diagnosis, and then you give more FSH, well, then the body's just being kind of bathed in FSH, and it's unlikely that the ovary will respond. So there are not a lot of options with IVF, nor are there with IUI, because the eggs are not being released. Now, I will say that the earlier a woman goes through premature ovarian failure, the more likely she will just spontaneously release an egg. And so in rare situations, we'll see women that have met this criteria that out of the blue turn out pregnant. We think, wow, how did that happen? Well, there must have been an egg inside that eventually just came out and they conceived. But those cases are few and far between. So what would one do in that situation? Well, the traditional treatment with premature ovarian failure is using donor eggs, using eggs from a woman that's young, that has full ovarian competency, that has a bunch of chromosomally normal eggs, and then produces those. Those are combined with the partner's sperm and used to create a baby and have the woman carry.
And let's be clear, or let me ask, premature ovarian failure, POF, does it interfere with the ability of a woman to carry a pregnancy? And that's different from getting pregnant, because if we use donor eggs, that takes care of the egg quality issue. But what about the ability to carry a pregnancy?
So for most conditions, the answer is there is no problem with carrying a baby. In other words, as long as the woman is healthy, and in other ways, she would likely, and her uterine cavity is normal, and the uterine cavity responds to estrogen, there usually is not a problem. Now, one of the exceptions there is if someone does have Turner syndrome. Turner syndrome is a situation where these women are lacking one chromosome. So it is a situation where instead of 46 chromosomes, they have 45. And it's called the 45X syndrome. Instead of 46XX, they're 46XY, or excuse me, they're 45X. And in those situations, there's an association with problems with the aortic root. And in pregnancy, that can become very severe since the blood volume is increased by about 50%. There have been cases of aortic root dissection and even maternal death. So that's where there's a big risk to carry the baby. But that's a rare exception. For the most part, there's usually not a problem with carrying.
And I have, and I believe this was a paper that was presented at ASRM a couple of years ago, talking about that, rather, something you mentioned earlier, and that is there, you would think in terms of throw more gonadotropins, that's the ovulatory stimulating drugs, at a woman who is at the beginning stages are in premature ovarian failure. But that there's some evidence to say that that's a better outcome, pregnancy outcome, with less gonadotropins being used. Am I remembering that correctly?
That's certainly an ongoing debate.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say, no, you're not remembering it correctly.
It's an ongoing debate. I don't think you'll find consensus on that point. What I think you will find, though, is if someone's endogenous FSH level is very, very high, it's highly unlikely that more FSH is going to be a benefit to cause ovulation induction.
And yeah, okay, so even then that would indicate that then using less of the drugs would be better, or perhaps none, I guess, at that point. Tell me about the study that you and Dr. Schoolcraft are currently working on. We originally reported on our website information about this study, and it was fascinating to me. So can you tell me about the study that you and Dr. Schoolcraft are doing?
Sure. So this is still in the experimental realm, but very exciting stuff. The study focuses on something called IVA, which is in vitro activation, which is a kind of a new concept, and the concept being that, you know, even when a woman goes through menopause, there are still some eggs that are left behind. So if you were to take the ovaries from a woman that's menopausal and you took them out and you dissected them and looked, you'd still probably find a few hundred eggs within them, but they've just not responded to any of the stimulation in the brain is sending down. What this study involves, and it's actually trying to replicate studies that were done over in Japan a while ago, is to take women with premature ovarian failure and to actually remove one ovary, to section it and freeze it, and then also to expose it to kind of a stimulation protocol, and then reimplant it back inside the body and see if that ovary is then invigorated to then produce follicles. And in that situation, it was done over in Japan. They had about 27 women that went through this, several of them did start to develop eggs again, and they've actually had two live births.
Interesting.
So right, pretty fascinating stuff.
When you say section it, I understand that is slicing it. I'm not that can't be right, because then you couldn't reimplant it. So I must have misunderstood that. So you take the ovary out, and the idea is that you're going to try to put it through some type of protocol that will jumpstart the remaining eggs, or try to.
Yes.
And then that ovary, after it goes through that protocol, is reimplanted into the woman.
It is reimplanted, but it is reimplanted after being kind of sliced up, if you will, in very small portions. And so when the ovary is reimplanted in the woman, multiple portions are put together. And then hopefully through the healing process, they'll grow back together and then be able to produce, establish a blood supply and reproduce eggs.
And what you are doing now is, this study, with the initial study, was with 27 women, and is your study going to be larger?
Well, it's just begun, and as of now, I think there have only been two women go through it, but it is available at our... the Colorado Center for Reproductive Medicine, where my partner, Dr. Bill Schoolcraft, is one of the principal investigators. And he he's doing it at his center there in Colorado. And I'm not sure how many there is their aim to have this done, but they're currently recruiting right now.
Okay, and so if members of our audience are interested in becoming a participant, do they need to live in Colorado?
I don't think they need to live there, but they need to be able to go there, because that's where the study will take place.
Okay, so and I will include a link tomorrow in the blog to the study. There's a page, I believe, on the Colorado Center for Reproductive Medicine site dedicated to the IVA study, and I will include a link in our blog on Thursday. For people who are listening to this a little later, that would be the Thursday, October 8th blog on the creatingafamily.org site. And I will include information there for if you're interested in participating in this study. You can contact the Colorado Center for Reproductive Medicine and Dr. Bill Schoolcraft, or you can also probably contact Houston IVF, and they can direct you, and that email is houstonivf.net. Did I get all that right, Dr. Hickman?
That's correct, yes. Our website is houstonivf.net.
Okay, good. Excellent. All right, perfect. Okay, now we've talked about the Western medical treatment, and truthfully, there's not a whole lot. Depending on whether you are how far down the process it's not a one-day event. You don't have ovaries one day and then the next day, generally, unless you've gone through things like chemotherapy or radiation, don't have them the next. So it's a gradual process. So depending upon when you seek treatment in that process. If you seek it further down the road when you have are much more progressed in POF, then there really, from a Western medicine standpoint, probably isn't a lot that can be done other than donor egg or participating in the study or any other studies that come down the pike. Is there anything do you know of any alternative treatments, Chinese medicine or any other alternative treatments that there's been study on or that you have heard of that might be effective at either slowing the progression of the failure, ovarian failure, or reversing it?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because when you talk about Western medicine versus Eastern medicine, it's kind of comparing apples to oranges. In that, you know, Western medicine is founded on the principles of the scientific method, where someone goes through something like a randomized controlled trial with two groups, and probably even placebo-controlled. Then you see if there's an effect of one medicine versus another, or if it's any better than doing nothing at all in the placebo group. In Eastern medicine, many of the successes are based on anecdotal reports. So someone might say, oh, I tried such and such, and I delivered a baby. And the question that the Western medicine physicians would always have would be, well, was that intervention that you tried truly the reason that you had the positive outcome, or would it have happened anyway without doing that intervention? So we don't really know. There certainly are some theories that things like acupuncture, Chinese herbs, may be of benefit. And you can make a scientific argument, certainly, for acupuncture. We know that in some situations, some women have a high vascular resistance, and when they're exposed to acupuncture, they lower that resistance and have increased uterine blood flow and probably then ovarian blood flow, and maybe that's all they need to get more a higher chance for an egg to be released. But we have not seen in randomized control trials successes like that. So,
it's a frustrating thing. And then when you talk with, as we have on the show, with practitioners of Chinese medicine or Eastern medicine, it's frustrating to them because they say that that's not how, you know, that the Western research protocols, the scientific method, which says that you have to use the exact procedure with each patient, is really flying in the face of the essence of what Chinese medicine is. So they feel like that the studies that have attempted to show things are not a fair representation. On the other hand, from a Western medicine standpoint, Western medical practitioners would argue, but if you don't have these, it's nothing more, as you point out, than anecdotal reporting.
Well, so I think both of those are very true. And I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle, in that clearly the more you know in life, the more you realize how much you don't know. And I think that holds true with Eastern medicine. Clearly it's been around for centuries, and if there was no effect, it would have died away a long time ago. So there's got to be something to it. I don't know if we know exactly what it is yet, but it is providing something. I think there's no doubt about that.
So going back to the idea of things that a woman can do to slow the progression of her ovarian depletion, assuming, and at this point I'm not necessarily looking at reversing it after she has officially reached the point of whatever the definition was, where 12 months without menstruation, as well as FSH levels in the menopausal range. But assuming that she knows that she has fewer, or she has been told that she is on the spectrum of POF, are there lifestyle changes? Are there dietary changes that she could make that might slow the progression of the depletion and give her more years of potentially being able to conceive?
That's a great question, and the answer is I'm sure you would avoid any potential stimulus that could hasten the depletion. So I would probably refer to your prior show with your physician from Stanford that went into environmental causes. That would probably be a good summary of things to avoid. But in general, there are not too many ways we know to prevent this from happening if someone's predisposed to it. So that changes the question, how do I prevent this, to what can I do about it? And it's typically earlier action. I know they're trying to do fertility preservation techniques. If one doesn't have a partner yet, maybe to freeze eggs, or to go ahead and be a little bit more aggressive with trying to conceive if one feels like one's ready at a certain time in life.
But that only applies if a woman has indication that she may be at increased risk for premature ovarian failure. So if she doesn't know that, what would she do?
Well, there's not a lot to say there other than avoiding environmental factors that could potentially cause that. Yeah.
Well,
so obviously not smoking
things.
What's that now?
And your point about acupuncture, there's probably little indication that it would hurt, and it's possible from what you're saying that if you can stimulate blood flow to the ovaries through acupuncture, that would be potentially good.
Yeah, in a certain group of patients, that's been shown to be the case. Probably doesn't apply to all, but that could help.
Yeah, or it certainly falls under the couldn't hurt category. And I do think, though, just to reiterate something that you said at the beginning, and that is one aspect of premature ovarian failure is infertility, but there are other health implications that so who would a woman see, assuming that pregnancy is at this point not what she is seeking, but she is wanting to take care of the other potential health consequences Would her general practitioner or internist or somebody, be whom she sees, or does she at that point also need to see a reproductive endocrinologist?
So many of those people can handle that same situation. So when we talk about the field of reproductive endocrinology, the full name is reproductive endocrinology and infertility. And so when someone practices purely reproductive endocrinology, they're usually looking at all aspects of hormone replacement and so forth. So that's certainly somebody that could be seen for this situation. Many OBGYNs would be able to treat premature ovarian failure also, as would internists. So I think you have a whole team of people that are ready and willing to treat this condition.
Okay, and on that note, we have come to the end of our time together. To our audience, if you have enjoyed this show and want to help us grow, please do us a favor and give us a rating on iTunes. As you know, we are the top rated show in this area on iTunes, and we would like to maintain our position there. We are also located on the iTunes homepage under What's Hot for Families and Children, and we'd like to maintain that position too. We're quite proud of it. So if you would, iTunes uses the rating system. We have wonderful ratings, and we would like to continue that. You can just type in Creating a Family into iTunes if it's on your phone or your computer, or you could go to the radio page of our website, creatingafamily.org/radioshow, and click on iTunes there. Excuse me, and it will take you directly to the rating page. Thank you so much, Dr. Timothy Hickman, for being our guest today on Creating a Family. If you want to participate in the discussion on the topics of this show, you can check out my blog tomorrow at creatingafamily.org/blog to get more information on Dr. Timothy Hickman or on Houston IVF or on the IVA treatment program study that's going on. You can go to their website, which is HoustonIVF.net. Thank you for joining us today, and I look forward to seeing you.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the...
Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, this is pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
And now, an ad from Dad.
All right, save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive. Can I take these off? All right. What is this? This looks good. Wow. That's well made. Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.